Welcome to the Plant a Trillion Trees podcast. I'm Eva Monheim.
And I'm Hal Rosner. We are both certified arborists through the International Society of Arboriculture. The purpose of our podcast is to encourage tree planting and proper tree care for our urban forests, which include neighborhoods, parks, and other open spaces.
We will also cover a myriad of tree topics, including the important role trees play in relationship to the climate crisis. Thank you for joining us. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Monheim Microphones. Monheim Microphones designs and handcrafts top-tier studio microphones and preamps right here in the United States in Hollywood, California. Their incredible line of innovative microphones and designs are used around the world by everyone from podcasters to top-charting record producers and singers. They recently released their new royalty microphone, Monheim Microphones Unparalleled Excellence, monheimmicrophones.com.
Verdant Earth Educators provides dynamic in-person training and online learning opportunities for environmental and horticultural businesses. Owned by ISA-certified arborists and former university faculty, the Verdant Earth Educator team provides consultations on tree care and recommends climate-resilient opportunities for your valued green spaces. Verdant Earth Educators is all about seeding knowledge for success. Find Verdant Earth Educators at verdanteartheducators.com.
This podcast is being recorded on October 6th, 2023. Joe Lamb, founder of the Borneo Project, is a writer, activist, and arborist living in Berkeley, California. Joe has degrees in biology, ecology, and film. He has taught biology and ecology in the United States and in Mexico. He worked as a field organizer on the Nuclear Weapons Freeze campaign and as a film distributor for the Video Project. For over 40 years, he has tended trees in the urban forest as co-owner of Brandy and Lamb Tree and Shrub Care. In 1991, under the auspices of Earth Island Institute, Joe founded the Borneo Project, an NGO that helps the indigenous peoples of Borneo secure land rights and protect their forests. Honored by the Goldman Foundation as an environmental hero, Joe was featured in the San Francisco public television program Green Means. For over 30 years, the Borneo Project has helped indigenous people map their lands, bring their case to the court of the public opinion, and press for the preservation of their forests through legal action. Welcome to the Plant a Trillion Trees podcast, Joe. We're delighted you could be with us today.
I am so very excited to be here. I can't tell you.
Well, you're a very interesting guest. You have a very broad background. You have 3 degrees, and you started the nonprofit, the Borneo Foundation. I mean, that kind of precedes you, but yeah, like, how did you get there?
It's been a very circuitous road. I was born in New Mexico, where I was raised, loved being raised in New Mexico in both Santa Fe and a little town called Pecos, which is about 27 miles outside of Santa Fe, and lived on the Pecos River for a while with my father on this little ranch there, and spent a lot of time riding horseback up in the wilderness in New Mexico, which is where I really fell in love with nature. And I guess fell in love with trees, really, during that time. That's where I started from. And then I was in the military for a while. I was a hospital corpsman during the Vietnam era. Not in Vietnam, but I worked mainly on psych wards and at the Naval Hospital in Philadelphia back in the day, which was, I think, the perfect place to be during that time. Giving aid and comfort to guys coming back from Vietnam was a really, I consider that a real honor to have done that. And then I've done a lot of wandering in and out of academia, you know, getting degrees. And I first thought I was going to be an anthropologist. And then later on, I got degrees in ecology and biology and thought I was going to be an academic. So I went to graduate school at the University of Minnesota to study community ecology, did some work in plant community ecology at that time, and then figured out that I wasn't really meant to be an academic and wanted to, in some senses, be more of an activist. So I left that graduate program and taught in a high school, taught in a prep school for a few years, taught biology and ecology and chemistry in a prep school, and then wound up in film school because I wanted to make films basically about the environmental crisis. And while I was in film school, it's really hard to, you know, I was kind of living a little bit off of the GI Bill, and a friend of mine had just started a tree company and I needed a way to stay alive. And so I started working for these two guys who had no idea what they were doing. You know, it was two guys in a pickup truck kind of tree company. And I'm fluent in Spanish. So I was able to kind of work my way into it, where I quickly became the foreman and the guy that was training the crew on how to do the work and climb. And then 40 years went by and here I am. And I'm so glad that I stumbled accidentally into arboriculture because I love it. I love the trees. I love the work. I love my crew. I love my clients. It was an accidental thing that was a very lucky thing.
Do you think it's like when I say passion, I mean, it's just a love that you almost kind of feel like you're being hugged, or how does it feel?
That's a pretty good definition, really. I do feel the sensation of affection, but both from my crew and I know this sounds weird, but you know, a really well pruned tree that you're taking care of. Maybe I'm projecting onto it, but it feels like the tree is happier after you get out of it. That's how you know if you've done a really good job on it, is if the tree feels happier to you.
I got goosebumps when you said that. My nickname is Standing Tree, so I get excited about those kind of things when people talk about trees. But wow, that's a wonderful feeling inside. And also with the trees, being with the trees.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit before we move into these questions, Joe. I guess the arborist in me and Eva would probably appreciate it. What kind of work are you getting in Berkeley, California? Do you prune a lot of oaks? Is it a lot of eucalyptus?
We work mainly doing residential trees, although we do some commercial trees. There's a few restaurants around here that we prune for. I'm very name droppy. So we just prune the monkey puzzle tree at Chez Panisse recently. I don't know if you know Chez Panisse, but
sure. It's the best name dropping you could do.
Yeah, I know. And we're going to try to, instead of getting paid for it, get gift certificates. But actually, we've been tending the tree for years.
That's a good swap.
Yeah, what do you think? You guys come to town and I'll take you to dinner. But we do mainly residential work and some commercial work. And we stopped doing large takedowns a while ago. We do medium to small takedowns, but we have kind of a niche where we are known in the area for making trees really beautiful. I mean, so we sort of work on a combination of aesthetics and tree health and safety, and increasingly working on fire pruning.
Sure.
The job that I set up this morning, the fire department had mandated that the client clear all this debris around her house and prune her blue atlas cedar away from these other trees. So we've done a fair amount of that, and I could probably double the size of my company easily if I were an aggressive businessman just doing fire pruning, because it's there's such a huge need for it. But
your crew must love you, because a tree that looks perfect when it's done and the clients love it, that must be a very gratifying feeling.
The real thing that keeps me from retiring at 73, because I could almost do it financially, I mean, not quite, but almost, is a commitment to the crew, because I've got guys that have been with me for 35, 40 years. And, you know, I like to think of myself as being a really good pruner, but it's been a long time since I've been in the trees doing what they're doing. But Leonardo Godoy, one of the guys in my company, who's in his mid-60s, is still climbing. We set up a job in Alameda Island the other a few months ago, and there are these two giant redwoods, and I get there, and he's getting ready to go up in one of them, and I have to pull him out of the tree and make him go into a smaller tree. But
wow.
But the strength of our company is really the quality of our workers and their commitment sure. to what it is that they're doing.
Sure.
I always used to sit down and just Google arborist and climate change, because you and I talked about this a little bit, Joe. Very interested in how the tree care industry is viewing the unfolding climate catastrophe. So clearly you're engaged with this crisis that humanity is facing. And I'm wondering what brought your awareness to this human-generated catastrophe as it unfolds. What were some of the things that woke you up to saying, hey, we got a situation here?
I realized that the first time I heard about climate change was when I was studying ecology way back at Western Washington University, Huxley College, back in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s. And in a class that I had on geology, they were talking about climate change then. And even in that class, they were talking about how old the idea was and how it was kind of on the table as something that we should be looking at. And it's, of course, something that's been known scientifically. I mean, I can't remember, like the 1800s, I think. I can't remember exactly. But that was what first piqued my interest. But I went to college when I decided I didn't want to be an anthropologist and decided I was interested in science. I went to college specifically to study ecology. That was what drew me to Huxley College in Western Washington. Huxley was the only one of two places in America where you could get an undergraduate degree in ecology at that time. That's why I went there. So it's kind of grown in me over a long time. And then when my daughter, who is now 21, so I guess was 16 years ago, turned 5, I decided that it was going to be really hard for me to retire because I had a child so late in life. But then in lieu of that, I could take these sabbaticals. So I worked it out with my partner and I took a year and went to Patagonia so that she could learn Spanish and my wife could learn Spanish and I could study the intersection of climate change and philosophy and religion. And I know that sounds like a really odd combination, but it was this kind of self-study thing where I spent a lot of time, you know, just walking around thinking about that and reading about it. And when I was not fly fishing, I admit that a lot of the time was spent fly fishing. But
you can do a lot of thinking during fly fishing.
You can do a lot of thinking during fishing. Especially because I'm not spending a lot of time catching them. So there's a lot of time left over. But I became convinced, just what I was reading then, you know, the IPCC reports and the other stuff, that we were facing a grave planetary crisis, and that it was really interesting that the world at large was so slow at waking up to that fact. That was fascinating to me, the level of the crisis and the slowness at which we were coming to just consciousness about the crisis.
So it sounded like it in organic fashion, it seeded into you as a younger man.
Yeah.
And has kind of, the rootlets have expanded in all directions, and you've grown into this beautiful arborist with a multidisciplinary background, which is what you want to have.
Hal, you're not using the word that you usually use, the rhizomorphicness of your root system.
Well, that has I've been mispronouncing
with
it.
The global soil.
you say it. I've been tripping up on that phrase. So thank you for picking me up.
You said that beautifully. I wish I could, you know, I trip up and just pronouncing mycorrhiza, you know.
You know, it's really interesting that you were saying, because the two of us don't think that was an odd combination at all, because we always come at it like I was doing a little meditation before we got started here. I mean, you know, that kind of thing, the spirituality of interconnectedness, people, plants, and whatever energy is coming through. You know, and whether you're fly fishing, whether you're in a tree, whether you're walking down a street, all of that is an important way to get to where you need to go.
That's a beautiful segue back to the Borneo Project, oddly enough.
Yes, let's talk about the Borneo Project.
Because when I was at that Rainforest Tribunal in Switzerland, one of my friends there who works for the Bruno Manser Fund, which is the nonprofit in Switzerland that's kind of a sister organization of the Borneo Project, that they work on an intersection of indigenous rights and rainforest preservation in Borneo the same way we do, although they're a much larger, super well-funded organization. But my friend Anina, who works there, did her PhD thesis based on, in part, this French anthropologist who studies people's different religious attitudes toward nature. And he just states the rather obvious thing that for the vast majority of human culture, there wasn't a nature-human split, that human beings believed that they were part of nature, and that that's a real recent thing that's happened in human culture, and that most indigenous religions still today view human beings in relationship to nature instead of something that's separated from nature. And that's a huge thing to me, whether you want to call it spiritual or philosophical or whatever you want to call it. But I think arborists work on that borderline because we're in the process of trying to create as beautiful and as healing and as, if you want to use the word, spiritual environment as we can. And that's, to me, that's not like a woo statement. It's just a statement of fact.
You can't separate it. You can't separate it.
Can't separate.
So what all went on with the tribunal in Switzerland? And let's go a little deeper on the Borneo Project.
So I was roped into the Borneo Project, or I was roped into the non-existent Borneo Project some 30-odd years ago, because the rainforests of Borneo were coming down at a rate that was unprecedented globally. More logs came out of Borneo in the late 80s and early 90s than out of all of Africa and all of South America combined, but yet it was not on much of the global radar. It was known in Europe, that it was not understood in America. In America, where people think about rainforests, they tend to think about the Amazon, or some people think about the Amazon and the Congo, but very few people think about Borneo. It's kind of off the charts. So friends of mine here who were in Berkeley city government were aware of what was going on in Borneo, and they enlisted me to go to Borneo in typical Berkeley fashion, form a sister city between Borneo and the longhouse in Borneo that had been where almost all of the villagers had been arrested because they were blockading logging roads that were ripping out their forests. So, you know, Berkeley catches a lot of flack for doing things like this, but some of the things that they've done have had real world consequences in a very positive way. They did a similar sister city with a township in South Africa back in the days of apartheid that prevented it from being bulldozed. So this was the same idea. We'll try to get some international attention around what's going on in Borneo. So I went there. It was illegal for me to go upriver where I went during that time because the very corrupt politicians in office at that time who were making, it's estimated, many billions, maybe as much as $20 billion from logging in Borneo. They wanted to prevent journalists or other people from seeing what was going on. And during that era, native peoples all over in Sarawak were blockading the logging roads, trying to protect their lands, sometimes at great personal risk. So I lied and said I was going to this tourist area and instead just went up this other river and went to the longhouse. And they loved the idea. And we spent this, if you ever go to a longhouse in Borneo, they oftentimes make you drink unbelievable amounts of this rice wine that each family makes. And we spent way too much time doing these drunken dances until 4 a.m. I mean, one of my strongest memory is trying to crawl off and go to sleep. And then this tattooed arm that's like from the fingers all the way up to her shoulder of this like 85-year-old woman reaching in and grabbing me and dragging me back out to the dance floor at 3 a.m. But I went there and fell in love with the people and came back. And then the project just started attracting people who had real scientific expertise in the area. And so the Borneo project then grew out of that, basically by just kind of, you know, build a fire and they will come kind of thing, to where it's now become this very effective organization. And we've gone from hiding from the government to working with the government. And we're in the process, along with the Bruno Mansour Fund, of hopefully creating a large indigenous managed park in a very sensitive area in Borneo that will provide a conduit between forested areas in Indonesian Borneo and forested areas in Malaysian Borneo. And I would have never thought that possible 30 years ago.
Yeah.
Wow, and you are the journeyman.
No, well, I get more credit for this than I deserve. In fact, the Goldman Awards people gave me an award as an environmental hero for this, but it should have gone not to me, but to the project and to all these other people, because I was just like one of the front men on it. But
you know, there always has to be someone who people trust enough that they can follow.
Yeah.
Or that they can listen to, or to put their hope into, because that in itself is empowering to the people who may not have felt that they had power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. Thank you.
So you're in metropolitan, I guess I can call Berkeley part of the Bay Area.
Sure.
And you certainly have seen prosperity and then the flip side of just horrible poverty and homelessness and people struggling to survive. That's the tension and the situation that we all face, at least in the States, living in big cities. So you wrote a letter titled On Trees and Democracy, an arborist's open letter to Herschel Walker. And it was directed towards this candidate who, kind of as a throwaway, said, "We've got enough trees." And you laid it out. I think you have 10 points in there. But what I loved, Joe, was the historical context that you set for that article, which was that your grandparents grew up in Oklahoma and that your grandfather planted trees. But talk a little bit about Roosevelt's trip and that seeing the need for shelter belts in the context of we can do this again, we can plant more trees.
Well, for me, the trees in that sense, trees is a way of helping to alleviate poverty and helping to alleviate human suffering while at the same time really protecting the environment. It's not an abstract idea, but kind of a very personal thing. And in some senses, a lived experience. And I remember when I was a little kid being at my grandfather's and grandmother's farm in Hammond, Oklahoma, where they had this river bottom land along the Ouachita River, and hunting squirrels with my grandfather in the tree belt that had been built. And I didn't know at the time that it had been built during the Dust Bowl by him as a way of protecting the land there. But they prospered during the Dust Bowl, even though the Dust Bowl was, you know, serious in the area where they were. I asked my Uncle Morris, who's in his 80s now and who was a young child back during that time, you know, if that was really a WPA thing and if it was really, you know, if the storms were really serious. And he said, yeah, that, you know, as a little kid, my grandmother would send him out to get the cattle when the storms were coming in, and he would have to find the tree row in the storm in order to find his way back to the house because it would be so blinding. So Oklahoma now is politically is so the opposite of what it was back at that time. At that time, the government was working with individual farmers, forming cooperatives in order to pool their resources so that they could tame the big climate disaster of the time, the Dust Bowl, and prosper and really protect each other's lives. And it was this great cooperation between the federal government, the state government, land grant colleges, and individual farmers. And there wasn't that split that there is now, to where things are seen as opposite, as these little compartments. I mean, in that time, I think there really was the practice of government of the people, by the people, and for the people,
They
recognized that it was, the federal government was the people. They're just other people, you know, but they're some of the same people as, you know, the people who are doing the farming. And it's really weird to me that there's this poison in the culture that has taken away that solidarity that we had, that kind of unity that we had.
What you're talking about is, you know, the idea of people forgetting the stories, you telling it and recollecting it, but people sometimes just don't want to remember stories because they're too painful and they move on with their lives and they never share those stories. But I remember similar stories hearing from my mom and dad because they were a whole nother generation. And the stories that they would hear in the East about how bad it was in the West.
Yeah.
And you know, what they didn't have during the 30s, you know, what the farmers didn't have. And sure, you could take our money, give it to the farmers in the West. We have plenty here. Take some, you know?
Yeah.
Or the tree lines that they made here in the Philadelphia region. Again, Roosevelt, when they're developing the roads, would build roads tree lined so that people knew that they were his hallmark.
Yeah.
You know, that whole thing is incredible.
I love the way you said that, you know, that I just had an image as you were saying that, of these tree lines sort of sewing the country together.
Yeah, well, you know, yeah, exactly.
Like one big crazy quilt, just kind of holding the different pieces of it together.
Yeah, hopefully the National Arbor Day is listening to this, and because that's a great idea, symbolically and otherwise. We haven't really talked about Bill Gates. Got a little bit of tree-related shout-out a week or two ago because he was kind of shrugging his shoulders and indifferent towards the trillion trees concept, you know, and of course we've named the podcast the Planet Trillion Trees podcast. But it seems that in reality, what we really need is for our urban centers to take on as much thoughtful, informed, strategic tree planting as possible. And one of the things that I loved about your piece in Common Dreams, Joe, was just we need to create jobs as well.
Yeah.
And that, you know, to have the underserved youth learning about trees, getting their hands dirty, using a shovel, but most importantly, you know, cooling their neighborhoods and watching this living thing grow. Again, it does take us to that spiritual plane, doesn't it?
It does indeed. That's exactly right. No, I love the way you framed that. That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think that in what you were saying there, that joint enterprise of us greening the commons and the urban commons can heal some of the not just environmental rifts, but the spiritual rifts in our country. I mean, there's all these studies that I'm sure you're aware of about how green areas reduce crime and reduce ADD, and, you know, hot cities have more riots, have more crimes, and it's all interconnected. And there is kind of an ecology of spirituality, which is another thing that trees really, really teach us there. And, you know, it's all so possible and real and accessible to us, and also essential. I mean, I'm one of those bad students who often procrastinates and then at the last minute does a lot of, you know, quick researching. So I was doing a little quick researching this morning before our podcast, and I just ran across this thing in Arizona about how there were 80 some people who had to go to the emergency room and had to go to the burn wards from falling on pavement that was so hot. And a significant number of them died. A lot of them had to go to ER. This is not just a, oh my gosh, wouldn't it be nice if we could do it kind of thing. This is like a protect people's lives and keep certain areas from falling apart kind of thing.
And what you're saying is it's not a luxury, it's a necessity.
It's not a luxury, it's a necessity. And it's an economic necessity too, because it's not like these things cost us. That's what we know in the tree industry, is that, you know, that you get back so much more per dollar spent on the urban forest. I mean, tangible goods, you know, like you can spend less on sewer replacement, storm sewage replacement. You don't have to pave your streets as often if they're covered by shade. You have fewer respiratory diseases if trees are absorbing these pollutants. I mean, the yield back is enormous, which my grandparents understood being farmers, because it's not like you're taking care of the nature on the farm because you're just a sweet guy. You're taking care of it because that's the way you make a living, because of all of the returns that come back to you. And the fact that we feel disconnected as a culture so far from nature is why Bill Gates could make such a stupid comment. I mean, I was raging with other friends who are in the climate movement about how certain people can fall, no matter how smart you are in some areas, you can fall prey to a kind of binary thinking, to where we have this really simplistic thing, because he believes in certain technological fixes because he's a techno guy. But right. For him to diss trees when the IPCC, when all of the...
Yeah.
When the Ford Foundation, when the National Science Foundation, when all of these other organizations are talking about the essential role of trees, not just in the rainforest, but in other places for climate change, for him to say, you know, I'm a science-based guy, it's like, dude, that's the thing that you just said is equally as stupid as me saying, oh my God, Facebook caused a genocide in Myanmar, therefore we should not, therefore computers should be outlawed, or computers are bad, or something, you know? I mean, it's equally that stupid, what I just said, in my opinion.
But you were talking about your grandparents, and I wanted to go back to something you said, that they took care of the environment. They knew that if they had cattle, they better provide shade, because those cattle would be dropping in the field. Yeah. When it's a hot day, you provide them water and you provide them shade.
Yeah.
And we don't even do that for our own people in a city. Like, yeah. What are we thinking?
Yeah.
Interesting.
I heard this podcast the other day about how our radio show about how Houston is trying, as a city, is trying to do something about climate change by encouraging people to take public transportation. But then they did this study that showed that their bus stops are so hot.
Yeah. Hot.
That they're hotter than the surrounding areas. And people, you know, that's a simple tree fix. Once again, I mean, you could design the bus stops better, but you could also have trees around the area to really cool it. And it's...
Bus stops are plastic. So it's like being in a plastic bag or on a hot day, you know, standing there waiting for the bus, and probably is 10 degrees hotter than it is outside the bus stand.
Right.
Just for clarification, what kind of trees did get planted for the shelter belts? Was that all cottonwood, or did they diversify? Or?
That's a really good question, and I'm going to have to go to my favorite answer, which is I wish I knew.
I think Eva's already Googling it.
Actually, I know here it was the London plane tree they used on all the streets. That was the signature tree that they used here. When you drive down some of the old roads, you'll actually see the old London plane trees, and those were all the roads that were built by, Roosevelt. And his programs. And so depending where you were in the country, they would pick a tree that was a good one to survive. In other words, they were picking for survival. They weren't picking for as beauty as much as survival.
Right. Which brings us to another point, which I think is really important, is that I love the way that our ideas can keep evolving about this, and that we can keep incorporating new ideas. And that there has been a lot of criticism of not your podcast, but just the trillion trees idea among certain people in the scientific community, because it's often misrepresented as people just planting monoculture plantations and doing these things that can be very destructive to the environment and have the opposite effect. But, you know, that's why we need an ecological complex approach, that it has to be not just the right tree in the right place, but the right tree in the right forested setting. And maybe it's not, you don't want to do a monoculture thing. You want to pick the right tree and its associates, which is another place where it segues into why arboriculture, in my opinion, should take on climate change as one of its central issues. And it should begin that by the process of learning as much as it can about, you know, the intersection of all of those things, about trying to, you know, make it a species mix? And, you know, what plants do you plant in association with it? And how do you make sure it stays alive? And, you know, and even in some cases where maybe you don't want trees, maybe you want grasses or, you know, but just a whole kind of broader approach. But I think you asked me as one of the questions of what did I think that arboriculture should do about this?
Yes, right.
One of the things I think they should do is pat themselves on the back. And really realize that, take a moment to just give yourself credit for the work that you do protecting the urban environment and protecting other environments, and realize that that's really important work. And in the recognition of that being really important work, that we can do it even better, and that there's a huge need for it. And in that sense, there should be a huge amount of money for it, and that there is money for it. And so that's, I think, the first thing that I'd say that arboriculture needs to do is really take it on, recognize that we stand at the center of that, because there's going to be a lot of people dying in urban environments all over the place.
Yeah.
Because the main cause of death from climate change is not hurricanes or wildfires,
right,
or any of that. It's heat, period.
Yeah.
And there's so many people that have died and that will die in the future, and trees offer a huge relief for that. But
yeah.
We really don't have anything comparable to the Borneo Project here in the United States, do we? For our people here. Do we have one? Can anybody think of one?
Okay, I'm gonna be thinking about that.
I'm trying to think, and I know there's a lot of different organizations that are planting trees.
Yeah.
But I mean one that'll take the cause for everybody. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I know we have the tree tenders here in Philadelphia, we have tree tenders in Pittsburgh. We have the Project Forest up in Canada. We have all these, but there's not one. And I know we have the International Society of Arboriculture, but I don't think that they've actually stepped up to give us that. In other words, have they?
Oh, I think they're kind of retooling in some fashion.
You think so?
Yeah. But, you know, maybe as example, we know that tree care industry does an exceptional job.
Yep.
A lot of times it's driven by the utility industry. But when a weather-related event rips through the South or something like that, you know that tree companies, whether under contract with EPA or municipalities, they will respond. You know, the power goes back on in a matter of weeks, and the trucks and the chippers and the crews, a lot of times, at least on this part of the United States, are heading south, you know, in response to that. 2 years ago, we had a tornado touchdown up in Eva's neighborhood, and, you know, the out-of-town tree companies were everywhere.
They were.
You flip that equation around a little bit and think, well, what if tree companies mobilized to plant? You know, what if they
just
were
like
heading
that
off, yeah, with thousands of bare root trees or whatever technology they want to apply there? You know, in Philly, we're an old city, and so we're dealing with hardscape. In about half the situations where we want to plant, we have to peel off about a 3-foot by 4-foot section of sidewalk before we can even plant. But, you know, the underserved neighborhoods are radiating sidewalk heat and row house heat. And, you know, my dream is that the International Society of Arboriculture can scale so that they are supporting all phases of tree growth and installation.
From seed to senescence, as
yes,
our friend John Mahoney would say out on the West Coast there, West right. Coast arborists.
Right.
Seed to senescence.
Well,
love it.
Well, this is the perfect point for me to segue in with. I have been feeling this calling to try to do something about arboriculture and climate change, and just felt stymied by the massiveness of it. So I want to heap huge praise and gratitude on you two, you two people right here, for what you're doing right now. Seriously, this is a super important thing that you're doing, because you're bridging all these worlds and drawing attention to it. And that's absolutely essential. And what you were saying about all those difficulties of peeling back the sidewalk and doing all that stuff, since it is essential, it has to be done, which means that there's going to be money there for people that are doing that. You know, it's a question of having the ISA ask for the funding and ask for the funding for for tree companies to retool and ask for the funding for, you know, really figuring out this mix and doing it in a scientific fashion, you know, to form other allegiances with city groups and with state governments, and to have the ISA become political for trees, not political as in Democrat or Republican or anything like that, but just in terms of doing the political work of networking and making it happen.
And you know, there's an organization I'm working with right now, and I said to them, if you want to go for a grant that is going to pay for training programs. Once the infrastructure is put in, you're going to need people to maintain it. That's what you're going to need. And so, you know, get that funding going now to think ahead, because once those trees are in, you're going to need people to maintain them.
Which is, once again, huge gratitude to you, because that's the difference between your trillion trees and the other trillion tree things that are out there, that some of which are boondoggles, because people just put them in and leave them. Yeah. It's like, okay, I'm going to have a child and just leave the child on the street, and that's all I have to do. You know, arborists understand that it's not just planting the tree, it's caring for the tree and getting the tree up to the point where it can survive for itself. And then even after that, you have to maintain it and get back in to it. And, you know, that's the whole difference between just it's like problems that we used to have in foreign aid, where they just like throw money out there and of course it wouldn't work. Mm-hmm. And arborists offer that knowledge of, it's planting the tree, but it's planting the tree right, and it's planting the right tree, and it's maintaining the tree, making sure it stays alive. And that involves training a lot of people, and that's a good thing.
Right. Well, that's where it's going to be. And we have to think ahead instead of, you know, always trying to put out fires, which we have been doing for the last, 10, 20 years, trying to put out fires, literally and figuratively. But the idea of the maintenance of trees, and I get really upset when people say, well, it's going to cost me money, I don't want to plant a tree. Think about what that tree is returning. And I'll never forget when I worked at the university, and our dean of the head of that campus said, oh, you know, we just got an evaluation of what the property's worth. And I said, did you value your trees and your shrub collections? And he said, what are you talking about? And I said, the tree value. Did you have somebody come in and do, because there's companies that do that. They come in and they value your trees, and never thought of it. And I said, you never thought of your trees, which is your biggest investment, because we teach horticulture, you know? I was shocked. I was absolutely shocked. And then when the tornado came through, it ripped out all their trees and collections.
Oh my gosh.
It ripped out all their trees and their collections. And what it's going to cost to replace 5,000 trees that got annihilated.
Yeah.
Catastrophic. Yeah.
Catastrophic.
Yeah. So, you know, we need to be thinking of all those things. And I'm glad that Hal found you.
And then in that regard, you know, I mean, one of the fundamental things you learn in ecology, and it just sort of blows your mind, and there is a spirituality to it, is that things are interconnected in ways that we don't really understand. And that's just an observation of basic physics and basic biology. A ton of carbon dioxide that's released, you know, on the freeway out, you know, not so far from my house, has the same global effect as a ton of carbon dioxide that's released from burning rainforest in Borneo. So in that sense, at the level of the problem, it's global, and you can't just kind of ignore the interconnectedness of it. But also at the level of the cure, it's global. I mean, every time you're improving it here and making it work here, that has a global effect, as it does in Borneo. If we stop the rainforest destruction around the planet, that's going to affect us here. You know, there's a significant amount of greenhouse gases that come off of rainforest destruction. I mean, and a lot more than all of airplanes flying. You know, I mean, it's mind-boggling, some of the numbers on that. And so, you know, at both the level of the problem and at the level of the cure, things are super interconnected and require us to think of it that way.
Well, you know, in the Project Borneo, when you're talking about the trees and the destruction, but I always think about the people, too, that are connected so close to that environment, that it's just like ripping out their heart. It's just like ripping out their heart. And people don't think about the other. They only think about themselves. And it's sad to say, but, you know, think about the other as that is their money. When I say money, that is their investment. That's their return. That's in their heart. And we just take it like it's nothing, you know?
That's exactly right. That's so true. And when I first went to Borneo to form the project, I was thinking about trees. But as soon as I got there and I was with them, I realized that that was a false thing, that I was thinking about people and trees in relationship with each other, and that it wasn't an easy divide that way. And like Jock Zhao, the leader of the of Umabawang, the longhouse that we formed the sister city with, he took me out into this place and I was looking up at these lianas crawling up into these huge trees and just all this wildness around me. And I was like, oh my God, thank you for taking me to this beautiful virgin forest. And he said, this is my father's farm. This is not virgin forest. Which is what they really discovered in the Amazon, that the, you know, that all of these places that we think of being virgin wildernesses around the planet were actually places that were highly modified by indigenous peoples over tens of thousands of years, producing this unbelievable diversity. I mean, the way it worked in Borneo is they had this traditional system called a dot, where they would have a big tract of land that would be owned by the communally, by the longhouse, and there'd be several sections of land, one that you would actually burn to the ground and then farm. And then there'd be a section next to it that was one that you left fallow that had been burned in previous years. And then there'd be one that you just left wild. And so that interaction of all of those three basic things produced the highest biodiversity, terrestrial biodiversity on the planet, by them always having a preserve that was untouched so that it would reseed the other area, and then have an area that they would leave fallow, and then an area that they would be communally farming. So what you were saying about it deeply affecting them is absolutely true. I heard a terrifying podcast about the effect of climate change on farmers in Australia, and the suicide rate among men was much higher farmers was much higher than it was among women, because the men would have such deep relationship with the animals that they were taking care of. And when those died during the droughts, it really messed them up. And the women had these communities that where they were much more, you know, had the community support around them, whereas men were more individualistic and out in the bush. But people do get deeply, I mean, farmers do get deeply involved, hunters do get deeply involved, fishermen do get deeply involved in the spiritually, if you want to say it that way.
I think it's spiritually. Definitely spiritual.
Just to circle back to International Society of Arboriculture and the Tree Care Industry Association and the American Society of Consulting Arborists. I mean, when I go to a meeting like I did earlier in the spring, you know, the New Jersey chapter is very vital and strong and has a nice event with great speakers, including a parallel day of talks to the Spanish-speaking community that attends. But when you walk, I'm sure you've had, both of you have had that experience of the trade show section of the conference, and you go in and it's got a military vibe to it. You know, the way the everything is oversized.
Yeah.
The chippers, the stump grinders, the chainsaws, the chipper beds, and then, you know, the full range of pest control treatments as well. And so in a way, I view it, you know, a little bit cynically, as like the arboriculture industry is cashing in pretty good on this climate crisis, because as we lose our elms, as we lose our ash, as we lose our red oaks on the East Coast to bacterial leaf scorch, it's kind of like the storm response I mentioned a few minutes ago. It's, there'll be a tree company there to handle it, and they are going to get paid. But that urban forest is taking a beating. I mean, we are harvesting those trees faster than we are replanting.
Yeah.
So I think what's appealing to me is, one thing we know, and you know this, Joe, about from running your own business, you know, if you have an arsenal or a collection of equipment to get your day-to-day jobs done. You've had to spend some money to get it, and you've had to take out your loans. There's a lot of business involved in running a tree pruning company. But I think commercial tree care owners understand business, and I think they just need to understand this is how you make money planting trees. Because planting day may not be that prosperous, but aftercare will. Aftercare will continue to be that right. That other income stream. Thank you.
Love that.
I love what you just said. And I think there might be ways to make it prosperous. Like what you were talking before about the need for training people, there could be a combination to where it's built into where they are subsidized by training local people that you're working their way out of poverty and how to assist with the plantings and how to then maintain the trees and how to get the buy-in on it. And there should be extra money for the teaching of that. I mean, you know, land grant colleges, which really one of the things that helped with the Dust Bowl, you know, those were funded. I mean, we should be funding, some of these tree companies should be making money for teaching people they should first learn how to do it really well themselves and then should make money, I think, from teaching the local people who are going to be invested in it the most. I don't know. I think we want to send you two on a national tour, traveling around the country. Talking to arborist organizations all over promoting this idea. I hereby promote that idea.
Well, in one of our podcasts, we heard that there's a shortage of seed. And we know that there's a shortage of seed because we can't grow the 3 billion trees that we're short. So, you know, collecting seeds, another opportunity for people to make money. And, you know, and to know where to go and when to go and which tree and, you know, so have trees marked in communities. And I was just at Longwood Gardens because I teach there and they have a beautiful alley of oak trees. I haven't told you this, Hal. The tree that I have on my list this week, my 15 plants, is white oak. So they have a beautiful white oak alley and the acorns are falling. And this year, some of the trees seem to have a mast year. And they were like hanging like little bundles of grapes on the tree. And I was like, wow, this is great. So we went over and we were talking about how they put the radicle down. As soon as they fall, they start to put the radicle down because they want to pull themselves into the ground. At least white oaks do and some other plants do. But anyway, so we walked over to the tree and it was almost like just as we get there, they're starting to put the radicles out. Falling. But we haven't had any rain. So it's usually right after that rain. And as we learned from David Tuschler, it's right after the rain that they put their little radicle down. But we started to kind of dig around in the mulch and we could find some that had already started to put the radicles down. And the idea of being able to collect acorns, having children do that, they can raise their college money for college by, you know, they're paying them $1 an acorn. I would do it. I don't know about you, but I would do it.
That's a brilliant idea. I love that. No, that's exactly right. Finding community ways to do it. Yeah, that's exactly right.
And you can pay off the kids.
Some churches, you know, locally,
exactly.
All kinds of,
Or that money could feed the cupboard or the food cupboard, for example. I mean, there's so much out there.
There is so much. That's beautiful. I love that. Thank you. That segues oddly, the tree nursery idea. I had one of the crazy, wonderful, odd things that happened to me in the Borneo project is that we gathered together a bunch of indigenous peoples from around the planet to this little conference that we held upriver in a longhouse that was threatened with destruction by a mega dam. One of our big fights was trying to stop these big mega dams from going in. And on that conference, we took with us these two Yurok natives, kids with us, Sammy and Jean-Luc Genshaw. And they, we become close friends. I love them. And they were some of the people that were instrumental in getting the Klamath dams to be removed so that the Klamath can be reestablished as a natural area and the salmon can come back to the area.
Mm.
But their tribe has been in anticipation of that as over a many year period has created this giant nursery of native trees to plant in the riparian areas and in the other exposed areas as that comes into being. So So working in conjunction with certain native groups in the area around native tree plantings is another, you know, another thing that could be kind of an interesting segue, because there's a lot of indigenous knowledge out there that's not really appreciated about restoration. California is really discovering that about fire ecology, that certain indigenous practices around fire ecology really make the area a lot safer, and that areas where indigenous peoples have been practicing their type of kind of checkerboard burning have done much better than other areas and in many of the firestorms that we've had around here. But
yeah.
Well, you know, talking about the salmon and the connection between the trees and the salmon and how important that is. I think it was Susan Smart's book who talks about, you know, you can actually see in the trees' rings the pinkness of from the salmon. When the bears would bring it from the river to the forest to eat it. And then they would leave the remains there, and the rings would have this pink color to it. And like there again, it's fertilizer for the young trees that are going in, or for the forest for that matter.
Yeah, so, Joe, I feel like we've made a spiritual compadre. Did I pronounce that?
Yes.
Yes.
And
I think so.
You know, with some of this thing. And, you know, we're always looking for arborists that are scratching their head and trying to answer the same questions that we batted around today. What's your favorite tree?
What's my favorite tree? Oh, that's such a good question. You know, I have a deep affection for aspens, in part for having been raised in New Mexico and spend a lot of time wandering in the aspen forest. And I love the fact that they root fuse and that, you know, you can be in this glade that's like all the trees are joined together in this massive thing. And I did a pilgrimage to Pando, you probably know Pando, the tree in the forest in Utah, where they're all the same individual and they think it may be as old as 10,000 years
old.
Yes. You know, that it just keeps sprouting up from its roots in the bottom. So I guess I'd have to say aspens, although I'm also really partial to the scrubby New Mexico junipers being raised there, just because of their power of endurance, the way they just slug it out of the, you know, this really hardscape landscape. How about your guys? What are your favorites?
Well, what about, wait a second, but you left out Borneo. What's your favorite one in Borneo?
Oh, my favorite one in Borneo. Well, my favorite one in Borneo has to be the durian, because it's just such a ridiculous tree. You know, it produces this fruit that you go around to the hotels there and they have little signs up with a cross across the Borneo, across the durian, no durians allowed. Because when you open it up, it smells like an open sewer.
Yes.
But the fruit is like prized by so many people as being one of the most delicious fruits on the planet. I mean, and it is an acquired taste, like, you know, really stinky blue cheese or something, but it is symphonic in its flavor, and it's such a big deal for the native people there. So I'd have to say that durian, I guess.
Well, they see, no matter where you go, you'll have a favorite tree.
Oh, what's yours?
I have a couple. One is crabapple. And that was because we had this huge, huge crabapple when we were kids in the garden. And it had beautiful pink flowers. So every time I looked out my bedroom window, there was this pink tree. And the crabapples were huge. They were bigger than an inch long. And we used to make crabapple jelly out of it, or jam. That was one tree. And the other ones were oaks. I like oaks. And I know this is not okay with some people politically, but I do like the mimosa tree, which is Albizia jubrizan, which we had in our backyard also. And that was a really good tree to sit in because the branches were low and it was just like the crabapple, only it was cooler. And it smelled good when the flowers were on.
Two great choices.
We've learned over the years, you know, your favorite tree choice is going to change. And it's a lot of factors that, you know, we just had a guest say, my favorite tree is the next one I'm going to see.
There you go. Hal, what's yours? Is that your answer too?
No. So, of course, Eva will have to help me with the pronunciation, but I'm pretty sure that the tree that's going to save us as a planet, at least north of the equator, is Acer Bergeranium.
Acer Bergeranium?
That would be it. Yes.
That's an interesting one.
And I think its common name is Trident maple.
It is the Trident maple. Yes.
Yeah. And I saw one the other day, and the reason I'm saying it's my favorite tree is I ID'd it right away, and I thought, you know, you just had that internal response, flicker of happy and flicker of joy, like, oh, there it is, right on the street, looking great, you know, 7 inches in caliper, not lifting the sidewalk, fully leafed out despite, you know, a fall heat wave. And then, like I say, a couple people that have compiled data says this one can be planted throughout Europe. It can be planted throughout the United States. Yeah. It's tough and it's not going to get gigantic. So that's my favorite
that's
tree.
That's great. Today.
Yeah.
Woo.
I love that. I love
now
all
Now I just trees. Have to learn how to pronounce it.
Yeah. Like, just think of geranium that is Bergeranium.
Okay. Bergeranium.
Yeah.
Okay.
Think of geranium.
Well, Jill, thank you so much. Every guest from California has just brought that California magic, man. So thank you for all that you're doing. I'm so glad the internet brought us together.
Yes. And LinkedIn and all these wonderful platforms that we see people on that we learn so much about.
And thank you so much for inviting me. I mean, I've longed to do something like this, and I really, really, really honor the work you're doing. It's really important.
Thank you so much. It's a great compliment coming from you. That's wonderful.
Oh, man, you guys are doing it. You're doing it. Thank you very much. I really appreciate you having me on.
Thanks, Joe.
Yeah, thank you. Take care.
Okay.
Thanks, Joe.
Bye.
Be well. Bye-bye.
The Plant a Trillion Trees podcast is edited by Andromeda Recordings in Hollywood, California. Thank you.